Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Joseph Brinton, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors, locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, week-long Washington, D.C. experiences, and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Washington Update, and today's speaker is Congressman Jim Matheson. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Good crowd here today. That's great to see everyone here, and we're on the campus. And whenever I come here, I always like to first talk about my relationship with the Hinckley Institute, because it's been such a great relationship over the years. Whether it's with my congressional office or with my political campaigns, we've had such tremendous students who have gone and done internships in either my political or my official office, and it's always been really gratifying for me to know that there are bright, motivated folks who want to be involved in the public policy world and get things done. And one of my most recent interns is right here, is Ellie, who was in our office in Washington this summer, and she was a true rock star and did a great job for us. And so I'm glad to see you again here today. It does mean a lot that the Hinckley Institute is really here. And I got to tell you something, for those of you who, you know, since you live here, you know this is what the Hinckley Institute is. This doesn't exist in other schools. This is a remarkable thing we have here at the University of Utah in terms of providing these opportunities for students to be involved in various public policy internships and whatnot. It's really a special thing, and I just like to always acknowledge that when I come here, because it's such an important thing for me. And a number of the folks who have been my Hinckley interns have moved on to work for me in my office, and been great employees, and so it's been a great source of talent. And so, as I say, whenever I come here, that's kind of like what I like to start about first. Well, it's start of the school year. Maybe not quite the start. You've been about a couple of weeks now. And I thought we'd talk about a few things that are interesting in our politics today. You know, one of the great acts of bipartisanship that took place this year had something to do with an issue that I think is important to all of you, because Congress voted in an extraordinarily bipartisan way to maintain the low interest rates on student loans. I suspect a few of you in here have taken advantage of the opportunities created by federal student aid through either grants or loans or work study or some combination thereof. The reason I suspect that is more than three-fourths of all college students in Utah take advantage of some combination of those items. And it's interesting to see that there was such bipartisan consensus about maintaining that type of commitment to the notion that in this country, if you want to accomplish something and have an advance, that education is such a critical tool in the toolbox to allow all of us as individuals to do that if we choose. It's sort of one of the great things about America is this opportunity for access to education. And we see it in our public school system, the K-12 system, but we also see it and we value it in our public policy world in terms of the post-secondary school opportunities as well. How appropriate, since this is a campaign season, that in the same week when my opponent was in Florida speaking to a party convention, and talking about the American dream, didn't mention that she wants to get rid of all federal student aid. Doesn't think we should make that investment in our people. And at the same time, I was conducting a press conference at Salt Lake Community College and had a couple of students, actually two from the University of Utah were there, had someone from ITT Tech, all these different institutions that allow people to pursue an education to better their lives. Because to me, that's one of the real cornerstones of the American dream. The opportunity to invest in yourself, to give yourself better skills, to be better educated. And it's not just good for you as an individual, but it's good for all of us when people pursue that. It's good for our country, it's good for our society, and it's clearly good for our state. I suspect a lot of you as students in college right now are focused on what the next steps are going to be for you. You've made the commitment to go to school, you've made the commitment to invest in yourself, and you're working hard. And you want to see what the opportunities are going to be in terms of employment and job opportunity and your access to those opportunities. And your being here now and the investment you're making in yourself creates a much longer menu of good choices. And that's something that I believe in real strongly. And that's why I was proud to vote for the legislation that passed Congress in a bipartisan way this summer to maintain the low student loan rates, which was, as I said, a large bipartisan. The current vice presidential nominee of the Republican Party, Paul Ryan, voted for that as well. Now, I just mentioned education and how you're investing in yourself. I guess we also might want to talk about what we mentioned in terms of that it leads you to what your next step is in your life. And it may be additional education. You may want to go to graduate school. You may want to get some type of different degree in addition. And that's a great choice for you. But ultimately, you also want to figure out ways to make sure that we can look at issues that matter to you about jobs and opportunity, because we all want to see if we can invest in policies that allow our economy to grow. Now, I don't think the government should be running our economy. That's not our economic model. We should look for policies that encourage good economic growth. I just talked about one, and that is our commitment as a country to allow people to improve themselves and build better skills and take that action on their own to pursue what they want to do to have a better life. That's great for them, but like I said, it's great for all of us in terms of our economy. We don't want to have some policy where we pull the rug out of 75% of college students and say, guess what, you can't afford to go to college now. That would be going in the wrong direction. What else do we want to do about our economic growth? You know, our state, relative to a lot of the country, is doing better. I spent a lot of time visiting a lot of Utah businesses because I learn a lot when I meet with folks about what the public policy means to them and how it affects what they're doing. And you can talk about every business sector it is. I visit high tech, healthcare, manufacturing, defense, energy. The message I get from all of them, large, small employers, whoever they are, is number one, we want an educated and well-skilled workforce. We want more certainty in public policy when it comes to taxes. We don't like where all these temporary tax provisions get put in place. We never know what the world's going to look like in 12 or 24 months. And we want more regulatory certainty. We don't know what the future looks like. When the government says we may do this, we may do that, we're going to change this regulation, but there's no clarity to that. I was just over with the Business and Research Park yesterday where that was their number one issue, was their concern about uncertainty in the future. You know, something I learned in business school, my first year of business school, it's kind of your basic thing you learn in one of your first business school classes, is that uncertainty is a cost. It's a risk. When you're making your business plan, you can't eliminate all uncertainty. None of us can fully predict the future, but you try to reduce the amount of uncertainty as best you can to make informed decisions. And it's important in the public policy world that that take place as well. Before I was elected to Congress, I personally worked in the energy business. I ran my own business. I know that world. And I'm pretty proud of my record that since I've been in Congress about supporting policies that help and not hinder the private sector. Let's talk about some of those I think are really good for our private sector investment in no particular order. I think one thing we need to talk about is our commitment to basic infrastructure. You probably didn't think I'd lead with that. But in a world where technology is changing so much of our economic livelihood and where globalization is such a dominant component in terms of how our economy works, turns out investment in basic infrastructure still means a lot. You got to move product. You got to have consumers who can get to work in an efficient way. Other countries around the world are making substantial investments, whether it's roads and bridges or port facilities. And that basic investment infrastructure has always been a great tradition in the United States of America. Quite candidly, a great bipartisan tradition. It's been one of those issue areas where the Democrats and Republicans have generally agreed and argued about the value of that investment. And I think that's something that we should always keep in mind because it keeps us competitive with the rest of the world. And I can tell you, talk to anybody at one of the package delivery services like UPS or FedEx. I meet with them a lot. I've ridden on the routes here in Utah where they deliver their product. Talk to anyone at any airport or talk to Union Pacific Railroad, which has a big presence here in Utah. Safe, efficient transportation is one of the building blocks for our economy. I support the type of infrastructure improvements that help U.S. companies. As I said, one of the other added benefits is commuters spend less time stuck in traffic, and that's good for everybody as well. Let's talk about another issue that I think really is important to building economic opportunity in our country, something I've felt real strongly about over the years and have a pretty strong record on, and that is the issue of promoting open trade policies. You know, when you think about it, the simple math is the United States has about 5% of the world's population. That means 95% of potential consumers live elsewhere. And again, I mentioned earlier how much technology and globalization have changed the world we're in compared to what it may have looked like 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. Now, change can be difficult to handle. There's no question about that. And certain industries benefit more than others from when those changes happen. But it's important to embrace change, in my opinion, and not be in denial about it. And I think it's important for U.S. companies to have access to markets overseas. Interestingly, Utah happens to be a pretty significant export state. You may not have known that, even though you live here. But it's a significant export state, and we've had a tremendous growth in exports for our economy. In fact, our exports grew this year by 14% compared to last year. That's double what the increase was for our country as a whole. And I meet with Utah businesses all the time. They tell me how important these trade agreements are, and that's why I was proud to support the most recent agreements were with the most recent big one was with Korea, a tremendous market for U.S. product. And Utah has a lot of industries that benefit from this, but I'll give you the big ones. It's minerals, the mineral industry. We got a lot of export from there. The nutritional supplement industry, a lot of export from there. And interestingly enough, agriculture. The pork processing facility down in Millard in Iron County, that's the largest pork processing facility west of Iowa. And a lot of that product actually gets shipped offshore. So open trade, embracing the open market, that's something that I've advocated for. I think that's good for our economy, good for business. And let me tell you something about that. When you look for open trade opportunities, we want everyone to play by the rules. We want people to be fair. It's not that easy to make that happen, so I don't want to sugarcoat this for you. But on balance, I think it's important that we look for opening those markets. Now I'm going to talk about a subset of trade issue that's a tax issue. And I know when you talk about tax issues, sometimes people get a little drowsy, so stay with me on this one because this is actually a good issue for how our economy can move forward. Remember I said the world has changed, our economy has changed so much, globalization has changed? Well, guess what? Our tax code is stuck in a 1986 paradigm because that's the last time taxes were reformed, major tax reform happened in the United States of America. 1986. Hadn't heard of the internet then, you know. So needless to say, times have changed. And our tax code, you're not going to believe this. Our tax code is one of only five countries in the world that says if a company from your country is selling product offshore and they make a profit, this is an oversimplification, we want to double tax it if you want to bring the money back home. We're one of only five countries that does that. Everyone else has figured this one out. Seems to me that if we want U.S. companies to sell their product abroad, we want to bring those profits back here, invest in plant and equipment, new jobs, right? It seems pretty straightforward, and yet our tax policy creates an incentive against that happening. It's estimated we've got about $2 trillion of private sector profits sitting offshore right now. And these companies are waiting to see if we change our tax policy or not. They're not going to wait forever. I think we want that money back here invested in the U.S. So I'm the lead Democrat, and Kevin Brady from Texas is the lead Republican on legislation called repatriation legislation, which allows this money to be repatriated back to the U.S. at a greatly reduced rate to bring this money back home. Now, our legislation is the immediate step we should take to let the air out of the balloon, if you will. There's broader tax reform that needs to happen. We need to overhaul our tax code. It shouldn't take one-time legislation like what Kevin Brady and I have proposed. And this is not what you hear about, and this isn't the headlines every day, but if you want to hear concrete examples in the public policy world of what we can do to help our economy grow, I've just given you one. And we have a lot of bipartisan co-sponsors on this bill right now. And I wish it had come up for a vote. I wish the leadership would bring it up for a vote in Congress, because I don't know who'd vote against it. Be the right thing to do. Let's talk about another issue. Another one that you probably didn't think we'd talk about, but I'm giving you some examples where you can really help our economy grow. And another example of where Congress came together in a bipartisan way. Because you don't hear about that much these days, do you? Generally, when you hear about what's going on in politics, it's all about the bickering and the polarization, and there is too much of that. But here's another example where Congress came together on a very complex issue. And that's the issue of our patent laws, which, again, hadn't been updated for a few decades. And, again, the world had changed in so many ways. And we were losing out on this intellectual property situation in our country. And Congress came together, agreed, since America's always been the world leader in innovation. That's one of our great core strengths that makes our economy so strong. We came together to reform our patent system. And Patent 101, you want to reward innovators, right? You want to reward them for what they do if they come up with new ideas so they get some exclusivity for a period of time to make some money on all the effort that they've done to create a product in the first place. That's sort of the basic concept. But as I said, in a bipartisan way, the biggest changes were passed to patent law since the Truman administration, the 1950s. Employers have helped Utah, and this is interesting for what it means here in Utah, because employers have helped Utah become the second highest per capita state in medical technology device jobs. It's over $500 million in payroll right here in Utah. And patented technologies have allowed those industries, like those jobs right here in Utah, to succeed. So I think that's a pretty big deal. Pretty big deal. Now, I talked about taxes in the one context of how you handle the foreign, the profits earned offshore and bringing them back home. There's a broader issue we ought to talk about in terms of tax policy. I mentioned at the outset of my comments, first of all, we need more certainty. You know, I think one of the challenges in the public policy world, and this is a bipartisan criticism, by the way, because I think members of both parties have encouraged lots of temporary policies that have expiration dates coming up, and so no one can plan for what the world will look like the next day. And in case you haven't noticed, sometimes Congress waits till the 11th hour before they make a decision. And that's not good for business. That's not good for anybody in terms of making decisions. So first of all, I think we ought to move ahead with clarity and long-term policy so people can make more rational decisions about the future. Secondly, I'm a big believer in reducing tax burden. I think we ought to reform our tax code, quite frankly. I think we ought to lower rates. I think we ought to eliminate a lot of the loopholes that special interests have obtained within our tax code. And interestingly enough, there's a lot of bipartisan agreement about that. If you listen on corporate tax reform at the highest level of what Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are saying about it, they're saying the same thing. They're saying lower the rates and broaden the base by closing up loopholes. So I think we actually have an opportunity as a country to make progress on that issue because there is that bipartisan consensus about trying to do that. And I think if we create a flatter, more transparent tax code, I think people will have more confidence in it. What I find when I talk to people around the state of Utah is that they're frustrated by the complexities of the tax code. They feel like they play by the rules, but they feel like that certain interests have been able to affect the tax code in a way that isn't fair. And so I think the notion of creating a flatter code that's more fair is something that we could all agree on. And I don't think that's a particularly ideological issue to you. I don't know where there's a difference between different areas of the political spectrum or different parties. Seems to me we all ought to be able to agree on that. And that doesn't mean you get rid of all deductions in the individual code. I think that there's some people who advocate going that far. I personally think the charitable and religious deduction ought to be maintained. I think the public policy that values private citizens making that decision is a good thing to do. And I think when it comes to mortgage interest, that the deductibility of that ought to be maintained. I think investment in a home is another part of the American dream that we talked about. And I think having public policy that encourages that is a good idea. And I think, again, there's bipartisan support for both of those things. I'm pretty proud when it comes to taxes of what I've done since I've been in office. I've really tried to reduce tax burdens on people. I'm proud of my record where I voted to cut taxes for individuals and for families and for businesses. We're in an election season, and so you're going to see some differences between me and my opponent on this issue. My record is one of cutting taxes. Her record is one of raising taxes. Over a three-year period, she raised taxes 150% on the residents of her city. I've been endorsed by two of the largest national business associations in no small part because of my record on taxes. I've been endorsed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in this race this year. I'm real proud of that. I've been endorsed by the National Federation of Independent Business, which represents small businesses across the country. These are nonpartisan entities that look at elected officials' records and determine if they take an effort that helps grow our economy in a pro-business way. And it's I'm real proud of those because it validates exactly what I said I would do in office and what I said I would be. And all these issues we talked about, whether it's infrastructure investment or trade or patent reform or tax reform, all those issues are what those organizations focus on as issues that help put our country in a position to have additional growth and opportunity for everybody. And at the end of the day, I think that's a pretty important part of how we're going to see a good future. Now, I mentioned at the start one other thing, and that is I used to work in the energy business, and I thought it would be helpful just to talk for a second about energy. Kind of exciting, actually, what's going on in the energy field, and sometimes you don't read about the good news in the newspaper, so I want to tell you something. Technology has created amazing opportunities. Technology has given us the ability to much more efficiently access resources, such that production... I'm going to split energy into two categories, transportation and other. The transportation side, do you know our reliance on foreign oil has dropped by a pretty good margin? In 2008, 57% of the oil we consumed in this country came from offshore. By 2011, it dropped down to 42%, 15-point drop. You never heard about that, did you? That's the good news. Why did that happen? Well, first I mentioned technology has helped in terms of access to resources. New methods for accessing oil, their domestic production has gone up. That's one factor. Another factor is from policies that were established years ago, and that is we're getting more efficient. The cars on the road get better miles to the gallon. And those policies are allowing all of us as consumers to get more miles to the gallon. Gasoline's it's too expensive for my taste right now, and I'm sure for all of you too, but I'm just suggesting some steps have been taken that have actually reduced our gas usage based on public policy that encouraged more efficient fuel economy standards. And something else has happened in the energy world during that same time frame, probably for primarily the reasons I just mentioned. Do you know which country in the world has reduced carbon emissions the most in the last 6 years? In the entire world, the greatest reduction of carbon emissions has been in the United States of America. Didn't read about that in the paper either, I bet. And it's because of technological advancement and greater efficiencies in how we utilize energy. And that's kind of the American way, that we think and we innovate and we always look to be more efficient and more productive. That's how we compete with the rest of the world. And that's what's going on in the energy markets right now that you don't hear about. And some of that was due to some public policy, and a lot of it was due to some private sector innovation, and it's really a feel-good story. Let me suggest a couple of steps that I think we could take that would really be a game changer, because even though we're down to 42% of our oil coming from offshore, I'd like to see that number even less. I think we all would. For our economy, I'd rather see in money invested here instead of offshore. And for the politics in the global scene, I'd rather see us have less reliance on those foreign sources of supply. And here's the exciting news there. There's on-the-shelf technology right now. You can run vehicles on natural gas. And remember I mentioned early technologies allowed us to access and increase our oil production in this country? Natural gas reserves that we can access in this country have exploded in the last few years in terms of the total volume that's available. And you can go get a natural gas vehicle right now if you go down. I'm not pitching a particular auto dealer or brand, but you can go buy a Honda Civic right now that runs on natural gas if you want. And there are filling stations all along the Wasatch Front. We have more filling stations per capita in Utah than any state in the country right now. And it's been a while, but I went to that station about a year ago, and it was fuel equivalent to gasoline when I filled the car with natural gas, $1.27 a gallon. Sounds a lot better than the $3.59 I just saw when I was driving over here today. Natural gas provides an opportunity for us to use our in the transportation sector to use a domestic resource that where there's a plentiful supply, so we're investing in our own country. It allows us to save money because it's a lot less expensive. And I'm not going to, you know, I know prices can fluctuate around, but at least right now on the horizon, it looks like those prices are going to be pretty stable. And for those of us who live in the western states like we do here with these high mountain valleys that have the challenges created by inversions each winter, it burns cleaner. It's better for the environment, better for the air. It's a real win, I think, for Utah, which produces a lot of natural gas, too. So I'm supportive of a bipartisan bill in Congress called the Natural Gas Act, which creates tax policy to encourage development of fueling stations and production of natural gas vehicles on a production line basis. Because if you want to get another car run on natural gas, you know what you got to do right now? You buy it when it was built for gasoline, then you got to pay a few $1,000 to convert it over. That's not a very efficient way to use our resources, is it? And so we want those vehicles produced at the front end that can run on natural gas. And so, again, that's maybe not an issue you've heard a lot about, but it's an issue that I think could really create a wonderful economic opportunity for our country in terms of growth, in terms of domestic investment, in terms of saving consumers money, and in terms of having cleaner air, particularly in a place like this valley where the majority of our pollution comes from vehicles. So I think that's a nice win. I think that as we've talked through a lot of these issues, we've talked about where technology has really helped us. And one of the other policies that has been helpful in that regard within the public policy world is to encourage investment in research and development. And so another component of our tax code has been something called the R&D tax credit. Always has bipartisan support, right? But for such great policy, why don't we just make it permanent? It always is extended for a year or two at a time. Everybody likes it. I don't care what party they are, everybody likes it, thinks it's a good idea. But we always tell the business community, well, we may or may, you know, we always give them that signal. They are given a mixed signal about whether it's going to continue or not. So that's just another example. I've talked about the benefit of technological innovation and what it means, and encouraging private sector innovation. Again, good public policy, something I think we ought to maintain over the long run. I think that when it comes to energy, as we were talking about it, we talked about the transportation sector. We can also talk about the utility generation sector. I think there are great opportunities for us to be more efficient. I think there are great opportunities for us to make it in as an efficient way as possible and use it in a more efficient way than we do right now. You know, one of the greatest inefficient uses of energy in our country today is in the commercial building sector. Commercial buildings generally are built where the landlord builds it, but the tenant pays the utility bills, so the landlord doesn't have much incentive to build it in a way that's real energy efficient because they're not paying the bills. I've introduced bipartisan legislation. It's me and a guy from New Hampshire named Charlie Bass. And we've introduced legislation that says let's take a look at allowing private sector entities to come in and sign energy service contracts with federal buildings. Where they come in, the private sector does, invests in efficiencies within the building to make them more efficient, and the way they get paid is through the energy savings over time. So there's no taxpayer money going out the door. It's a shared savings, if you will, between the energy service company and the taxpayer. Those are the ideas we ought to be talking about. Again, I don't know anybody who disagrees with this idea. The most recent example where you saw it in the private sector that gets a lot of publicity around the country is the Empire State Building. They did that. But I think there are a tremendous number of buildings in the public sector where we could achieve those efficiencies. And that's legislation I'm real proud of, and I'd like to see it move forward. You may have heard a common theme as I talk about bills that I've introduced. I always do it with someone from the other party. You know, if you really study the Constitution and look at the way the legislative process is set up, it was set up to build consensus to get something done. And when you see too much partisanship or bickering in Washington, Have you noticed you don't see a lot of productive activity going on? The productive activity comes when people come together, build consensus, agree on how you make progress. And so for me, I've always tried to find someone to do a bill with me. So we take the partisanship, we try to take the partisanship out at the outset. It's been a very effective way for me to get things done. And as I said, the bills we've talked about, I think I've mentioned a number of examples where I've done just that. I'll talk about one other thing in the energy field that I think is a local issue that means a lot to me. We have on the banks of the Colorado River, you may have heard of this, down in Moab, we have a pile that used to have 16.5 million tons of radioactive tailings. It's back from the Cold War era. There was a uranium processing mill right there on the river, and it went bankrupt, and now the Department of Energy owns the site. It was leaking so much stuff into the Colorado River, not just radioactive, other stuff too, that if you took a cage with 100 minnows and you dip it down the water, you'd pull them up and they'd be dead. And that's not good. And I've been a real advocate in saying we need to clean that location up, because when the environmental impact statement was completed on this project, they said it is a near certainty that at some point the Colorado River is going to wash that thing downstream because it's right on the banks. And you got about 25 million users of Colorado River downstream from Moab. So the folks in southern Utah and Arizona and Nevada and California also have an interest in what's going on with this tailings pile. And I'm proud that we've made progress. It's been a big priority for me to get that pile cleaned up, and we've made some progress. I hope we can maintain that progress. I mentioned earlier that, you know, we're in a campaign season. I have an opponent who wants to eliminate the Department of Energy. I don't know what that would mean for the cleanup of the tailings pile in Moab. That's who's managing that now. Do we just not clean up our sites anymore if we get rid of the Department of Energy? It's an interesting question to think about. I see a huge benefit to doing that. It's the right thing to do. Now, I just want to close with a couple of thoughts, and then we'll talk about what we all want to talk about. I think policy matters. The people you elect to office, it matters. And when you choose to represent you, whether it's local or state or federal. And in politics, you hear a lot of talk. And it's important to also look at what people's records are. Whether it's the presidential race or going down to city council, you get a lot of rhetoric out there. And I think it's important to go a step below that and look at specific issues and look at specific policies. That's really the way we should make more informed decisions. If it's your mom, you should take the call. I always have that rule. If moms call, you get to pick up the phone. There you go. You better take. I always answer it with my mom. I'm telling you, it's like. And I encourage you to do that, not just in the political season we're in now, but I would encourage that as a lesson for all of us as we are involved in politics over time. Is let's take the time to really understand. Take a step beyond rhetoric and look at the reality of issue positions and a track record of what people have actually done. I'm in a race right now where the contrast is pretty stark between the two of us on a lot of issues. I've mentioned a few of them today. I've mentioned student loans, and I've mentioned Department of Energy. I mentioned I cut taxes, and she's raised taxes. There are a lot more. And I think it's important to get beyond the simple rhetoric and look at those specific issues and see what the record is and what the policies are going forward. At the end of the day, I tell people that one of my primary objectives in this job is to make sure we get things done. And so when I say it, I mean it. When I say I want to put Utah first. Those are the politics I grew up with, politics I grew up from my mom and dad. Maybe a lot of you students here weren't born when my dad was in office. My dad was governor years ago. And I grew up in a family that always valued the notion of public service and of making the world a better place. My family roots are pretty deep here. I go back six generations, and that's just something that has always been a discussion item around the family dinner table from generation to generation to generation. And so I share some of your frustration when you see the polarization and the bickering that seems to have too much of a role in our politics today. I share your frustration when you say, I want to have folks who are looking for something a little different, a little better. And I think, as you, I share what you think, that on most of these issues, they're kind of complicated issues. And isn't it interesting that our dialogue tries to reduce all issues down to where there are only two ways to look at them? And that all of one party thinks one way and all of another party thinks the other, and that the only two ways to think about an issue? Life generally isn't that simple, is it? There are some absolutes in life, there's no question. But a lot of these issues, you've got to look at it from multiple points of view, and you try to build consensus to make some progress. Since opening football games tonight, I'll use the sports analogy, at least move the ball down the field. That's kind of the way I think we ought to look at public policy discussions and public policy ideas, and that ought to be our motivation as we try to address these complex issues of the day. So as I say, I see that frustration, but I also have given you some examples where I've seen bipartisanship work, and I gave you some today. The trade issues, the infrastructure issues, the patent reform, student loans. There's a bipartisan consensus that still gets things done, and that's the path we need to take if we want to find a way to get something done. I've seen it produce results. It's why I'm proud of my record. It's why I'm proud of my approach. It's why I continue to be an independent voice. It's why I'm continuing to look for good public policies. And I continue to try to do what's right for my state. I have to say one more thing about, since we're on the campus here. This university is a tremendous asset for our state in so many ways. It's also been a tremendous asset for my congressional office, not beyond the students who've come to work with me, but the faculty and the brain power at this university has been a great resource for my office when we have questions about issues. Because the rule in my office is, you've got to have a good contact list of people you can call, who you can trust, who can explain what's going on. And whether it's folks at the university, whether it's folks in various businesses across the various industries in Utah, that's been the way my office and my staff have tried to operate from day one. And the university's been a great partner and a great source of information. And again, you all attend this university, so you're probably proud of it already, but I just want to give you a little more context on why I think you should be proud of this institution. Because it has such credibility on the national scene, and it's always been a place where I've been able to rely on people to give me good, solid, accurate information that makes me a more informed congressman. And so I wanted to close with that acknowledgement of what the university has meant to me and my office. And with that, I don't know how much time we have left, Jane, but I'm happy to talk to folks about whatever they want to talk about. Okay, that's great. That's great. So.
We'll devote the remainder of the time to questions from the audience. If you have a question, please state your name, speak clearly into the microphone, and a little bit about yourself.
My name's Clint Williams. I'm a second-year economics student. My question is just, what committees do you serve on, Representative, in Congress?
Sure. Great question. I don't know how much y'all have studied the way Congress has said, but you said, what committees am I on? And, you know, the House and the Senate have a little bit different set of rules, a little bit different structure. In the Senate, senators are on are on more committees, and in the Senate, the rules often let senators offer amendments to bills when they come out on the Senate floor, even if you're not on a committee. There's a lot of flexibility, and sometimes that's why the Senate moves slower. The House of Representatives is a little more structured. Often when bills come to the floor for all 435 people to consider, there is a rule that restricts the total number of amendments that can be discussed. But in the committees, that's where everything happens. And so the House, in some ways, is a very committee-driven institution. And the way the House of Representatives is set up is there are three committees that are like, they have different terms. They're the A committees or the exclusive committees. They're the best committees. One of them is the Ways and Means Committee. That's the committee that sets tax policy. The other is an appropriations committee. That's the one that does specific spending allocations. The third one is called the Energy and Commerce Committee, which is the one of which I'm a member. The Energy and Commerce Committee is the policy committee. It has the broadest jurisdiction of any committee in the House of Representatives. It does everything because in addition to energy, health care, telecommunications, food and drug safety, even sports, by the way, which we don't do a lot on sports, but it's part of the jurisdiction. It also includes all interstate and foreign commerce issues. And when you think about that, if it includes interstate and foreign commerce, that touches just about everything. It took me a little time to get on that committee because it's such a preferred committee in Congress. And it's interesting, in my lifetime, when I look at Utah having representation on any of these three big committees, it's pretty rare. There's a congressman from Utah County named Howard Nielsen who was on Energy and Commerce in the 80s. There's a congressman from Weber County named Gunn McKay who was on the Appropriations Committee in the 70s. In my lifetime, that's about all I know is the two of them and me. And I'm real proud to be on that committee because I think that's where, if you want to be into policy and really broad-based policy that affects what's going on in this country, that's the committee. And it's a real coup, I think, for our state because we have a small delegation that they have a member on that committee. And so that's where I am. Now, historically, I want to mention one other committee that I've been on, but since I mentioned Energy and Commerce is an exclusive committee, once you get on it, you don't get to be on any others unless you can get a waiver. But for several years, I was also on the House Science Committee. The House Science Committee, probably one of the least partisan committees in Congress, because there really shouldn't be anything partisan about science, although that's happening a little bit in our political dialogue today. That's the committee that's in charge of looking at where federal research efforts take place. It's involved with the National Science Foundation, the National Academies of Science. Those are the entities that, quite frankly, along with the National Institutes of Health, which is under Energy and Commerce, provide a lot of research dollars that are coming to the University of Utah that allow your graduate students and your faculty to perform the way they do, and they give this university the national reputation that it has. And so I love being on that committee. It's a great committee. But to be on Energy and Commerce, I had to make a choice. Look, when you're looking at committees in Congress, it's like picking among your kids. You know, you hate to have to make a choice because they're all good committees and they're all interesting issues. But again, I just want to emphasize Energy and Commerce is, from my personal perspective, it's the most powerful, most important committee in Congress, and I'm thrilled to be a member of that committee.
So I'm Brian Scott Allen, political science major. I'm in my last year here. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned several times that Congress is highly partisan. And my question is how can we in this room and continue on and maybe trying to limit or eliminate the partisanship in politics today?
Sure. It's a great question. You know, there's a movement going on in the United States right now. I don't know if you've heard this, where a lot of people are registering as independents now. If you knew that, they're leaving both parties. They're feeling that frustration we talked about earlier. And yet our political system is structured around this two-party system, which creates some challenges for how you affect change. Now, in my personal opinion, I talk to a lot of people in Utah, whether they're, again, Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, whatever they are, the vast majority are looking for more a constructive approach than what they see from a lot of elected officials today. And so my belief is that elected officials ultimately do respond to overwhelming public opinion. And I think that opinion has to be expressed as strongly as possible by folks about what we're looking for. Here's the catch. I mentioned earlier we're structured in a system of where the two parties are pretty dominant. And the processes for selecting the nominees that go on the ballot in November are dominated by sort of the more active elements of the two parties, which tend to be more ideologically extreme. And Utah has a system that is the most restrictive, least participatory of all 50 states, interestingly enough, in how we select our nominees with our caucus and convention process. Nobody else in the country does it like us. But the answer, and this may not be the easiest answer to implement, is the way to address this is more people just have to be engaged. Our political system is dominated by the shrill voices. And I think there's that group of people out there that's the majority of America. Again, if you strip away the term Democrat or Republican and you just kind of plot people on an ideological scale in the United States, I think you get kind of a bell curve. I think most people in this country are rather centrist in their beliefs. As a country, we have so much in common. We really do as Americans. We seem, unfortunately, in our political dialogue to always focus on our differences. We have a lot in common. You know, we're not out on the left like Venezuela, and we're not out on the right like North Korea. You know, we occupy a certain segment of the political spectrum here in America, and I think that there's that majority that are in the top part of that bell curve that don't engage in the political nominating processes of the two parties. And that's, I think, what encourages some of this more polarized dynamic. And various interest groups and the parties have gotten much more sophisticated at pushing certain agendas. And I think that's what creates a frustration for all of us. So, you know, just to close and answer your question, what you can do, I said we have to encourage a greater level of engagement and dialogue. We also have to get away from a lot of the silly rhetoric that's out there in our politics today. I mean, these cable channels, whether they're on the left or the right, you know, I mean, they call themselves news channels. Is it really news? Don't you think it's all opinion, right? Everyone gets that. It's not straight news. And I think we need to make sure people have that awareness about what are the facts compared to what's the rhetoric. And so I'm not giving you an easy answer where that's an easy path forward, but to me that's ultimately the solution's got to go. But in my mind, as I said at the start, there's this current in America where people are asking for something better. That one current's going this way about wanting more constructive discussion, less polarization. Our political system seems to be going the other way. It's like 180 degrees. That can't continue. It just can't. And I believe ultimately the political system's going to respond to where the public would like it to go, but it will respond more quickly the more people are engaged. I think that's really the key thing. Democracies, you know, democratic systems like we have in the United States of America, I think they perform better when there's more participation. The more participation, the more you have a collective effort to get things done, the more you attract lots of different points of view. Because like I said earlier, these issues of the day, isn't it a shame that often in our discussions we reduce the issues to simplistic two-dimensional issues? And life is usually more complicated than that. In fact, can I give one example of that? I know this is a long answer, but I want to give one quick example. I'll give you a quick one. Public lands issues in Utah. You get a lot of rhetoric, you get a lot of emotion about them, don't you? And you get a lot of people screaming at each other. And not much progress ever seems to get made. Well, I'm real proud of what I did on that issue. Senator Bennett, who's Republican, worked with me, and we created a process in Washington County, Utah, about what are they going to do with their public lands. And guess what? There weren't two points of view. There were 23 points of view, because we had 23 different stakeholder groups sitting around the table talking about what we should do for the future of Washington County. And it's amazing when you get people around a table with 23 points of view, you think that might make a mess. Actually, it was interesting how much consensus existed among those 23 points of view. At the end of the day, it took 5 years of hard work to do this. I don't want to say this is easy, but after 5 years, we passed legislation through the Congress in a bipartisan way. It created wilderness. It created off-road vehicle trails. It created corridors for utilities. Everybody probably didn't get everything they wanted, but everyone bought into a consensus approach. That's the way our politics ought to work. And like I said, it isn't easy, and it's not simple, and it's not always really exciting. Some of those meetings got pretty long and arduous to get through. But if you ever want to make progress on these issues, that's the approach we really need, and that's a bill. The first public lands issue, major public lands bill for Utah land since 1984 was that bill that passed just in 2009. I'm getting the two-minute mark, so I'm going to close with this. I appreciate y'all taking the time to be here today. I think it's great that you're here. I mentioned, you asked, what can you do? I said, be engaged. You are engaged. You're here. You're here, and you're part of this process. And I think as you go through your life, whether you're involved in the political and public policy world, or if you're not, and a lot of you are probably going to choose some vocation outside of the political and public policy world, that doesn't mean you don't want to be engaged. In fact, we need more people from different sectors of our economy engaged in public policy. In my opinion, I think that's what would help, as opposed to just having career politicians. I feel like my experience, having been in the energy industry for 13 years, has given me perspective and run my own business, things like that. That's given me perspective that makes me a better congressman. And so what I would say to you as you go forward is wherever you go in life and whatever you're trying to do, just try to keep one toe in the water of the public policy world and keep engaged, because it really does matter. It matters to have those points of view and those perspectives, and I think it's the way we make a difference and we make progress. So again, I want to thank the Hinckley Institute for inviting me here today, and I think some of you are in a class that was scheduled to go an hour and a half, and I'm not sure what you're doing for the last half hour, but we were booked to come here, and I'm running off now to another campus to do another one of these events. So, again, thanks so much. Appreciate the time.